Welcome to This Wild Life, a conservation podcast that brings you up to date with frontline conservation efforts from around the world. Expect stories of wild adventures and get to know the characters who are dedicating their lives to protect our beautiful planet. We're here to bring the wild to you. Hello and welcome to yet another episode of This Wildlife Podcast. I'm your host, Amy Turner, and today's episode is going to be taking you off the African continent and into some colder territories. Now, I'm thrilled to announce that we are joined today by Dr. Rodney Jackson and Ashley Lutz-Nelson from the Snow Leopard Conservancy. Rodney, the executive director, is the leading expert on snow leopards. Rodney undertook a pioneering radio tracking study in the 1980s on snow leopards in the Nepalese Himalaya. And it was a study that led to a huge cover story in National Geographic. He has trained biologists across many of the snow leopard's 12 range countries, and Rodney has 30 years of experience and passion for helping local people exist alongside the elusive snow leopard. Our other wonderful guest for today is Ashley Lutz-Nelson. Ashley is the Vice President of the Snow Leopard Conservancy and has 18 years of wildlife conservation experience behind her. Her achievements include a master's degree in wild animal biology from the Royal Veterinary College and Zoology Society in London. And Ashley was the assistant curator of carnivores and in charge of managing the care and conservation of snow leopards at the San Francisco Zoo. It's safe to say that there is expertise in the highest of quantities on today's episode. So, Rodney, Ashley, a huge welcome onto the show. It's a complete pleasure to have you both here.
Thank you, Amy. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful stuff. Now, I'm sure we're going to learn lots today, and we will be talking all about all aspects of the Snow Leopard and the Snow Leopard Conservancy. But as usual on the podcast, we love to hear people's backgrounds. So, Rodney, should we start with you to give a little bit of an insight about how you came to work on these incredible creatures?
Well, I guess what I would have to say, never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined that I would end up studying snow leopards. Basically, because I was born and grew up in Africa. And, you know, where else is there more wildlife? And if you have an interest as a naturalist, you want to become a biologist, why the heck would you go anywhere but back to Africa? I came to North America to get my master's degree, and that's where my life changed. And it changed from a photograph of all things. I picked up National Geographic, and I saw the first snow leopard image that was ever published, really, by George Schaller. It was beautiful. It captivated me. And I said, okay, on the way back to Africa, I'm going via Asia. Well, I never got back to Africa. I stayed in Asia. So then there was a challenge. I went to a very remote part of Nepal, probably only about the second Westerner ever to go there. It took 15 days of walking to get into it. And I was in the midst of great snow leopard habitat. But I realized there were problems. People were trapping the animal, trapping the prey base. And it came at a time that George has just given up on studying snow leopards in Pakistan because they were always poached before he was able to trap and put on radio collars. And, you know, I thought, well, I was interested in getting photographs of snow leopards. I did not get a photograph. George got that. But, yeah, and I went to this very remote area and saw snow leopard sign, but never the cats, but a lot of evidence of poaching by local people. And I realized that, you know, instead of trying to get a picture of a snow leopard, what I should be doing is trying to study them, especially because George Shala had been unsuccessful in Pakistan to do that, again, yeah, because of poaching. And I had an ideal study area that, you know, was remote and that I thought we could deal with the poaching. However, the study was difficult, and it was not until I won the Rolex Award for Enterprises that provided the funding and the guarantee to the Nepalese government, who was willing to entertain it. However, it did need the permission of the King of Nepal to approve the project, which I never met the king, but somebody in the wildlife department did and advocated the study. And so that's how it all started. And between 1981 and 1985, we call it five snow leopards. We tracked them over that 3.5 year period and got the seminal information on the species that basically lasted for the next 19, 20 years until satellite telemetry became a feasible option of studying this elusive ghost of the mountains.
Wow. I mean, Rodney, it really goes to show the depth of knowledge and what a fascinating background you have. It's completely obvious to see you're right at the forefront and an absolute pioneer of snow leopard conservation. And Ashley, how did you come to be in this position and involved with conserving the snow leopard?
Yeah, so my background has been in animal care. I grew up in Florida, St. Petersburg of Tampa Bay, Florida. And my father was a veterinarian. So I basically grew up in his veterinary clinic, helping with treatments and surgeries as soon as I could walk. And I had a strong affinity toward cats from an extremely young age. I was apparently a very social child, except if it came to a cat, then my full attention was on a cat. Anywhere I went, I tried to take my cats with me. And just so for me, it was always cats. But I thought I would follow in my father's footsteps. So I was pre-veterinary and went to University of Florida for my undergraduate degree. I was in zoology and I was on the pre-veterinary track, but I really wanted to try working with wildlife. And to become a wildlife veterinarian is incredibly difficult and competitive. And I wasn't sure that that would ever lead me to being able to focus on cats. So I got a volunteership at our local zoo, which is called Lowry Park Zoo. It's now called Zoo Tampa. And I was working with the veterinary team and I fell in love with it. I loved working with the wildlife. I was working with the apes. And I landed a job working with the carnivores, and the rest was history. I fell in love with working with we had five tigers at the time, and lions, hyenas, all sorts of wonderful carnivore species. And I just completely fell in love with that aspect of it. So, and it was very difficult to leave, but I left to go to London to take a sabbatical for that master's degree. And that really set me into the career of field conservation. So that eventually led me out to San Francisco. As you mentioned, I did work at San Francisco Zoo as the assistant curator of carnivores, and of the 12 species I worked with, the snow leopards captivated my heart. We had seven individuals there that I had the extraordinary privilege to work with, and I just became completely smitten with the species and really wanted to try to help make a bigger impact. So started getting more involved with conservation, and plus working, you know, to save these species in the wild, it completely relies on working with the communities. And I really enjoyed working with people and fixing some of those bigger problems. And I felt comfortable moving over to field conservation to try to make a bigger impact for the species, these individuals, like the ones that I had gotten to know and love so much, to help them in the wild.
Oh, well, what a journey you've been on as well. Great to hear slightly different ways into it. And I'm sure it's inspirational for our listeners to show, you know, there are lots of different paths into conservation. Now, moving on to the snow leopards themselves and their beautiful big cats, but highly elusive. So let's hear about them. Where do they live, and what are the threats to these amazing creatures?
Yes, so snow leopards live in the most remote habitat in the world, rugged mountain terrain, extremely steep ridges, cliffs, ravines. And Dr. Jackson says the more rugged the terrain, the better. They live across 12 different countries in Central Asia. So Russia, Mongolia, China, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Pakistan, Afghanistan,
wow.
Nepal, India, Bhutan. So such a wide range, over almost 2 million square kilometers, mm-hmm. and connected through these mountains and plateaus that provide valuable resources for the community in terms of water and other valuable, important, essential resources. Mm-hmm. And their adaptations make them specifically acclimated to live in this really remote, harsh environment. So they're very difficult to study in this region, but they face many threats. And most of that is in line with pastoralism, and agropastoralism is the main predominant land use in this area. So they overlap with snow leopards in these remote areas.
Oh, okay.
And they are dependent on their livestock for their livelihood. So they have sheep and goats, yaks, cattle, horses, and they are in competition with snow leopards for natural prey base, and their livestock is overgrazing this land. So they're, unfortunately, that leads to human wildlife conflict in these areas. So that is probably the main threat to snow leopards in this area. Mm-hmm. But there are also many more issues, including poaching is an issue for the illegal wildlife trade. As tigers and lions become mm-hmm. more endangered, the value of their bones in the illegal wildlife market does go up, and that poachers do turn to snow leopards for that as well, for their exquisite fur and their bones. Other issues, other threats include development, infrastructure development, mining, transboundary roads and rail passages to connect Europe and China. There are a lot of different challenges in the immediate and then also in the future with climate change. So the populations are difficult to assess, but throughout the years from Dr. Jackson's pioneering studies in the 80s to more recently, they've been classified as endangered because of their numbers being somewhere between 4,000 and 7,500 individuals. And it's very difficult to assess exactly the amount of individuals and the number of breeding individuals, which is estimated currently to be between 2,700 and 3,300 individuals.
Okay.
So they were listed as endangered historically until recently in 2017. The most recent population assessments relisted them as vulnerable, but with populations decreasing because of these threats mm. that are ongoing. Mm. In these mountainous areas. So the biggest challenges would be human wildlife conflict and mitigating conflict with farmers as their number one conservation action.
Mm. Didn't expect snow leopards to be under threat by poaching. But, then again, I've done so many of these episodes and I'm starting to realize that I should never be surprised about the poaching situation, and I'm sure our listeners are very used to the term human wildlife conflict by now, especially with the large carnivores. So that comes as less of a surprise. Now, Rodney, having heard about the extensive threats from Ashley there on the snow leopards, I want to talk to you as the founder of the Snow Leopard Conservancy. So could you tell us a bit about how you operate and the work you do in order to save this species?
Snow Leopard Conservancy, SLC, we started in 2000. And it really based on about 35, 40 years of me working in the field with other organizations and as an independent biologist. So right after the telemetry study, my focus was on training park rangers, wardens in surveying snow leopards, because we really needed answers to the question, how many snow leopards are there out there?
Okay.
And the population the estimates that Ashley's just given are total guesstimates, actually. Mm. Even after, well, I guess it's approaching 50 years from the first study, we still do not know really how many snorlax are out there. Oh, okay. And the problems are because, you know, it's exceptionally difficult to count a ghost that is always hiding itself and has superb camouflage. Mm. But I did realize, working with the park people, that parks had often good populations of snorlax, but they were too small to sustain a viable number on their own. That they interlinked it and with one another, and it's the corridors between the parks that also need attention, where the communities reside primarily. So my focus basically was on identifying human wildlife conflicts and finding solutions for them, training park rangers on how to deal with those problems, and as well as monitoring the cat, and learning more about snow leopard habitat so we could model the species and predict more accurately where it might occur, and then align our surveys to these places. We can't survey 3.5 million square kilometers, which is their sort of total estimated range of where they could occur.
Wow.
They obviously don't occur everywhere, but they're sparsely distributed. And then we have these hot spots here or there, often in national parks where there's good numbers. But we had a problem, and the problem was, well, the local people really didn't care one hoot about snow leopards. In fact, they saw snow leopards as a pest that would be best eliminated. The reason for that, obviously, was that it killed their livestock. Mm. Their livestock was their money in the bank. Mm. And the worst case scenario would inevitably be a cat coming down to the village at nighttime, or an isolated household, jumping into the livestock pen where all the sheep and goats and some yaks might be kept, and then killing everything. And obviously, no way, could it eat all of that stuff. So it's going on a mass killing spree because these animals are milling around, confusing, and it thinks it's got a prey to bring down all the time. Mm. The livestock can't run away as they do in the wild prey or livestock in the open range. So the goal of the SLC then was basically to engage local communities and people to monitor the cats and to act as the frontline guardians, the stewards for snow leopards.
Brilliant.
We wanted to make sure that snow leopards would be valued more alive than dead. To do that, we had to bring value to the local people, to encourage them, for them to want to protect this cat.
Well, I must say, you've done some amazing work since you set the Snow Leopard Conservancy up, and you continue to do so. And also, it's quite interesting to me that although it doesn't come as a shock that snow leopards and farmers clash, I always think of them as so highly elusive that I'm kind of shocked that they go anywhere near humans. Very, very interesting. Now, you also mentioned that a crucial part of your work is the monitoring of the species. And in many species of animals, they're hard to track. But snow leopards seem like they are on another level when it comes to monitoring them, due to the terrain that they live in, the tiny population that exists, and even political reasons. So Rodney, could you explain more about the challenges of monitoring and researching these snow leopards?
Yeah, monitoring is one of the most challenging things you can possibly imagine. How do you find and count the ghosts of the mountains that is very rarely seen? You could almost count the sightings on one hand back in the 80s, because the cat was just so incredibly elusive. Mm-hmm. And this was prior to camera trapping, prior to genetic analysis. All we had were our eyes and our boots to get muddy in the field, to go out and look for the cats. If we never saw the cats, what the heck are we going to do? Fortunately, snow leopards are, although they're solitary, they're extremely social felids. and they leave a lot of sign in the environment, not for us, but for their associated animals who live in the same home ranges, same areas. And they're communicating to one another. Males are trying to get access to as many females as possible so they can spread their genes. Females are trying to raise and protect their young in habitat that has sufficient prey, so they've got to identify those sites. And then once a year, when a female is ready to breed again, she has to find a male, the male has to find the female. The problem being that you might only have two cats in 100 square kilometers. How do they find themselves? Mm. Well, the key is in that period when she is in estrus, which is about a 2 to 4 week period, or maybe a little bit more, but she only comes in estrus once a year. It's very seasonal. It's in winter. Those cats are coming into their core areas, and they walk in common trails. The trails may be along the top of ridgelines. They may be wild prey trails of blue sheep or the ibex. Along those trails, wherever there's a bend, where there's a promontory, where you can see out over the landscape, those cats will leave their sign. Sign can consist of a drop-in. It can consist of a scent mark on a rock where they actually turn their backs and spray on the rock and leave their scent. It consists of raking their claws on a tree trunk or a log. Mm. And it consists of something that's highly indicative of snow leopards, and that is a scrape. And a scrape is formed by the cat shuffling on its two back feet, alternately making a heart-shaped mark in the ground, a depression with a pile of dirt at one end. And on that pile of dirt, it will take a dump, it will urinate. That urine, that dump, that scent mark tells everything about the individual, what its sex is, I'm sure to the other cats, which individual it is, whether it's ready to mate or not ready to mate, or get the hell out of here, you're a male that shouldn't be here. All that's great information. So we decided to use it by creating sign transects that we called SLIMS, Snow Leopard Information Management System. And that's the kind of thing that a park ranger, that a villager, that a scientist, that everybody could walk along a known footpath, a transect, and enumerate every time they see the sign and record. And, you know, you would say the more sign you see, the better habitat it is for snow leopards generally. It's not a precise relationship, obviously, but it's an index that could be used, and a simple index. It doesn't need fancy equipment like camera traps or genetic labs. So all went well with that, and we developed a handbook, and park people, where they had the resources, went out and did the surveys. Then one problem came up, and the problem was an obvious one, is that scientists put their attention more on scats. And unfortunately, the size of the scat is not indicative of the species, because a fox can leave a big scat, a snow leopard can leave a small scat. We call them token scats, because if you're a snow leopard and you mark in your environment and it's such a big space, you just mark it with everything you can. So you take a small dump instead of a big dump. And you take 10 small dumps instead of one dump, right? And it's going to mark more area. So the problem came up. Yeah, we count all those scats. It could be foxes. They could be all sorts of things. So the scientific community said, nope, SLIMS will not work. Well, I challenged them for that. Yes, we don't look at scats. I totally agree with that. We don't look at pug marks, footprints, because, you know, they're hard to identify a wolf from a snow leopard often, because the substrate is very coarse and gravelly. But the scrape is absolutely definitive. The only other animal that in that area that leaves a scrape is the common leopard, but it leaves a different shapescape. And number two, it occurs at lower elevations, so you can separate them. So I still say we should go with the sign transects.
Mm, okay.
Now, the new ones are the new techniques. Camera trapping has really grown since about, I'd say 2005 or 6 or somewhere there, since we did our first one in the early 2000s. And they have been used everywhere. They are now the tool of preference to monitor snow leopards. Along in isolated situations, in some countries, not all, collection of scats and DNA analysis. In reality, my opinion is that scat collection and analysis at qualified labs within the region, shared by the countries, would be the most cost-effective and quickest method of getting a total estimated count. Camera traps are very difficult to deploy because you imagine you got to walk multiple times into that environment to check the camera traps. You can't just go one time like you can with scats, and as long as you age the scats correctly. So these are new challenges, you know. The advantage of camera trapping, of course, is that it gives you pictures of snow leopards, and that those images, if well composed, allow you to identify individuals, which is a great advantage. It's difficult to identify sexes, but you can do it, at least for adults, not otherwise, maybe. And you can get females with cubs, so you know you're having reproduction, and you can get an estimate of litter size, at least when they begin to travel at 2 months of age. So these are all great advantages, but they require enormous resources. And my opinion is that we need to do the monitoring, but we can't wait for the results before we decide to involve ourselves or to highlight and emphasize conservation.
Okay, that's an interesting point there. You know, it's not a case of you have years and years to wait. It absolutely could be too late by then. And there's field work and there's field work. And I've got to say, I kind of alluded to it before, but researching snow leopards looks to be up there with the toughest of all species. Now, that's the monitoring side of things, but community-based conservation is a major strand of your work. So Ashley, could you give us some insight into this?
Yeah, absolutely. So community-based conservation is at the very, heart of what we do. It's working with our partners in country to work with these local communities in a really highly participatory way to find out, what the major conflict is and find ways to help them with alternate livelihoods and diversifying their livelihoods to really incentivize living near this large predator that is, can be seen as a pest as opposed to a value part of the ecosystem. So we work with in a lot of different ways. We engage through education and these livelihood programs, particularly engaging women, empowering women and indigenous cultures to have an equal say in these conservation actions. And so we work across 7 different countries and have various different programs within these communities. So one of the ones I wanted to highlight is we work with and we've created an organization called Land of the Snow Leopard Network. And this was formed in 2013 with 8 founding members and has expanded to over 100 different members throughout 4 different countries in Central Asia. And working to revive traditional knowledge in these communities, along with this snow leopard as a sacred species, while also building capacity for practical techniques to mitigate conflict, because there are conflict in these communities as well. So working to incentivize financially with their improving their livelihoods by protecting using tools such as fox lights and predator-proofing corrals so that snow leopards are not able to attack livestock. So it improves their livestock, or improves their livelihood financially, but also intrinsically by reviving their cultural heritage and reinstilling the knowledge of why this predator is such a sacred species. One of the programs we work with is in Pakistan. Our partners, Baltistan Wildlife Conservation and Development Organization, Ghulam Muhammad is our partner in Pakistan, and he works with these education and conservation programs in these poor, in these marginalized rural communities. They're typically 40% living under the poverty line with $500 annual income. And so he works with these communities, goes to schools to create awareness around snow leopards and giving, particularly really engaging girls that don't have as much of an equal opportunity in education in this area. So he works with them to instill the value of snow leopards and conservation efforts, while also working with communities on predator-proofing corrals. So there are multifaceted ways to approach and work with the communities to really incentivize living near these predators. And one of the most successful programs has been through ecotourism, and that's been one of the things that Snow Leopard Conservancy has been focusing on. And one of the good examples of that is in India, in Ladakh, and it's called the Himalayan Homestays. So I don't know if, Rodney, you wanted to talk about how the homestays have worked?
Yeah, so the homestays actually was really got us started in about 2003 to 2007. We met with a lot of villagers, and it was actually a woman's idea, because at that time we had a UNESCO grant to promote tourism in the area, and meetings involved government officials and people from the tourism sector, and they were all pushing hotels and a costly infrastructure. And it was actually a village woman that said, no, we don't want a hotel in our village. We want to preserve our culture. We like the village the way it is, but we can do homestays. And a traditional homestay, is where you go and stay with a family for a night. You have the food that they cook for you. It's not foreign food. It's traditional things. And you have the opportunity to observe how people live, to interact with the kids, to interact with family members, and to the degree that language allows, to find out, what their interests and priorities in life. And it's totally changed. So prior to this, snow leopards were being continually harassed and blamed for depredation. People were totally fixated, and they laughed at us when we came there and said, we're the Snow Leopard Conservancy. They said, how can you name yourself after such a despised pest? And we thought, oh boy, okay. And it highlights the need for having very strong leadership locally. And we had Renshin, who was respected, and who would tell us outright if we were doing something that was not respective of the traditional culture, or that wouldn't go anywhere because it had unintended consequences, right? That kind of stuff. Anyway, from that, so if you go to communities and you start from the viewpoint of what are they proud of, what are their successes, you're going to move much more quickly. You're going to build confidence in them. You're going to respect what they do. Typically, they expect NGOs and government to come to them to solve their problems. And their problems are big things, like we need hospitals, we need roads, things that only government can do. But that the cost is enormous, and there's no way the government can service thousands of villages immediately. Mm-hmm. So how can we build a community that is more proactive and thinking about with the resources they got, what can they do to protect their heritage, both natural and that's where it all came from. And now they basically recognize that animal husbandry just doesn't return the income, tourism does, and they're going to focus on that. Brilliant. Of course, the pandemic, COVID-19, has hit a huge hit, not only in Ladakh, but globally, and especially for tourism. And it highlights the need not to drop tourism, but to support it with diversified incomes and other sources of revenue. And that's what I want to just make a brief mention of. I want to thank your UK government for the Darwin Initiative program that it has, which is a wonderful program for supporting innovative conservation initiatives, given the money that we can test things, that we can figure out what works and how to make it better. And in Nepal, we have an emergent situation where the government has become more decentralized and they're giving much greater autonomy and authority to local communities for biodiversity conservation with some resources. So this grant is allowing us to identify and work with local women and men associations, really, community level, not at a household level per se, to come up with enterprises, economic enterprises. We are helping them identify them. We're helping them develop a business plan, a simple business plan that they can take to the local, what we call the Gaonpalika, which is really the municipality. And the municipality has some resources to fund that. And we can co-finance it. So that way, communities get their entrepreneurial economic livelihoods supported. And I think that's the future, really. I think it's blending of economic incentives with environmental responsibilities for sound stewardship that are monitored. And so anything, you know, really has to be, they have to prove that they are, in fact, saving snow leopards. And the more they save them, the more support that should be given to the communities.
There's some really interesting points in there. Now, this leads me on to the next topic in terms of using the local knowledge and using the local people to help in the research and help to save these animals. It's all very much intertwined. And you've mentioned before that although technology is a huge part of snow leopard conservation, I think I'm right in believing that you're keen that it's not used at the exclusion of everything else. So, Rodney, would you mind expanding on this, as I think a lot of people would find it quite interesting?
Yes, technology is great, but technology can exclude people who don't have the resources or the knowledge or the skills to access that technology. And we should never forget that local people who have lived in the Himalayas for hundreds of years in the harshest environment you can possibly imagine have survived, and they have vibrant cultures that differ between valleys. It's way more rich than, you know, our country is, for example. And we ought to take advantage of that traditional knowledge. So scientists really, you know, they can pursue good science. They can insist that conservation be good, be based on good science. But for that conservation measure to be accepted and acknowledged by local communities, they have to value it as well. They're going to value it through their lenses, through their eyes. Their eyes are traditional knowledge, stories about animals. Every animal has a story. Every animal is seen as an individual. They're not just a faceless cat. They are a certain cat that they know lives there. It lives there because the deities have, you know, decided that it's okay for them to live there, and therefore we must coexist with them as well. So I would say to scientists, please incorporate, start with traditional knowledge. Take it seriously. Even if it looks wiki and weird to you and it's hard to test using hypotheses, it's still important.
Well, that's a very poignant message, because I know we have many budding conservation biologists listening to this, and I imagine that would be an interesting point to pick up on. Well, sadly, we're going to have to wrap it up there. I'm sure there is hours more that we could record on your work. It's such a vast amount of work that the Snow Leopard Conservancy does. But have either of you got any last messages or suggestions about how we at home can support, even if we can't spend weeks in the mountains of Kazakhstan trying to monitor these amazing animals for ourselves?
Oh, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk. And we're so excited that to all of the listeners out there, thank you for being interested in snow leopards and learning about our work. And, you know, there are so many different ways to contribute. Of course, we appreciate funding for our partners. We provide technical and funding support for these programs in the field that directly conserve snow leopards. So, but other than funding, there are other ways through raising awareness, spreading the word. Some people don't even don't know about snow leopards. And so sharing, spreading awareness about, educational awareness about snow leopards and the challenges they face, sharing that with everybody you know. And also, if you have technical skills, so conservation requires people from all different backgrounds in finance and marketing and innovation and engineering and all sorts of backgrounds. So no matter what your background is and what your skills are, if you're interested and passionate in getting involved, we really, could use experts from lots of different fields it really takes a village to save the species. And everybody, a really global collaborative approach. So there are lots of different ways, but we do have social media. You could follow us. We do share our partners' work as well through that. And Rodney, do you have any other ways you'd like to suggest?
Well, I think you covered a lot of things, but I would just reiterate that change is only going to come about if we all act collectively together. And really, Jane Goodall, I think, makes the point that every individual, no matter whether you're a 6-year-old or a 99-year-old, you can make a difference. It's by many people acting together with small differences, we end up with major accomplishments happen. And we should always remember that. And I think we can make a difference to Central Asia and South Asian communities, although we live on the other side of the world. This is a cat we all treasure. It's a global treasure. And we have a responsibility, I think, to help communities who are living close to the poverty line to preserve their heritages. So I just want to thank everybody who supported snow leopard conservation organizations, individuals, and governments over these years that have kept this cat with us. And let's make it even more secure a future. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And what a brilliant, hopeful message to end with. Ashley and Rodney, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today. And really, this is just the tip of the iceberg for your work. And I'm sure we'll have to have you back on in the near future. But thanks again. It's been a fabulous insight into the world of these amazing animals and the Snow Leopard Conservancy.
Pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you. Stay safe.
Thank you very much. That'd be wonderful. Take care.
You've listened to this wildlife podcast. Just to let you know, we have extended the trail camera competition to Tuesday, the 22nd of September. So that's next Tuesday. And all you have to do is head over to iTunes, leave us a review, and then we will be choosing a winner at random. Thanks to all of the entries so far. We love seeing your reviews because it means that the organisations and individuals on the front line of conservation are being heard by more and more people. And I've rattled on about this before, but that is really what it's all about. We hope you all have a great day wherever you are in the world. Look after yourselves. And of course, we will be back next week. And this time, we are going to be dipping our toes back into the ocean and heading into Alaska. We are This Wildlife Podcast, and we're here to bring the wild to you.